I'm Cara Lawrence, and my guest today is the guest soloist of the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra, performing Saturday night in Miller Auditorium. Her name is Liza Verstman. Liza Verstman.
That's right.
And from the Netherlands,
yes.
Where you grew up,
yep.
And attended school in the United States.
You went I to did.
Curtis?
I did, yeah.
So let's get some of the story of your life out of the way. I understand you grew up in a very musical family.
I did. My parents, they're from Russian heritage. They came before I was born. They immigrated to the Netherlands. And my father is a cellist and my mother is a pianist. So there was music all around me all the time. And my sister used to play the piano when I was younger as well. She did quit at some point, but the rest of the family kept going.
When you were a little girl, did you have any musical obsessions over pieces or players?
Good question. Well, I quite vividly remember, and also there are pictures from this, when my sister did still used to play the piano, she would play a Chopin Revolutionary Etude, and being a very... a little girl with a big imagination, I would be dancing to it and having all these dramatic scenes in my head about it, about war and all kinds of things. And so, yeah, I guess that piece was, I was obsessing about it a bit.
So it was very, very normal to use classical music as a play, something to play with.
Totally.
To use your imagination.
Totally. Because I, my parents would have a lot of records with, I'm not sure what they're called in English, actually. So children's stories, but in Russian, on record. And they would usually be accompanied by incredibly enticing music, classical music, usually composed for those children's play and fairy tales. But that just got, because you didn't have image, you just had the audio, it sparked so much everything you can have with your fantasy and imagination. It was great.
Did your parents invite other musicians to the house?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, so that was a huge influence. And so because their inner circle, all their friends basically were musicians as well. And they grew up in this musical surrounding also in Moscow. And in that time, in the 70s and 80s, a lot of them immigrated to the West. And so they were very happy to see each other again then in Holland. And I'm sure that's the way how I also got to the violin, because when people ask me about why did you choose the violin, I don't remember, but I know that we had so many great musician and violinist friends around, and I must have just pointed at it and went like, I want that.
So you didn't feel too much pressure? It was just a natural...
Yeah, it was totally natural, sort of. Then later on, of course, being professionals, my parents did know what it takes. It's a funny combination. I never felt really pressured, because they never said, okay, you cannot leave your room until you've practiced whatever, 5-6 hours. It was never the case. Actually, my older sister was the one that was much more strict. Every time I wanted to stop practicing and play with my toys, she would go like, oh, are you ready to play it in the Concertgebouw, which is the major concert hall in Amsterdam? And my parents were much more relaxed about it. But they just did underline that if you wanted to get anywhere, yeah, well, you would need to work for it.
You then worked with a teacher, and I've lost his name from my memory, but he was a very influential figure.
Yeah, there was this one family friend who was an amazing violinist, and unfortunately he died soon. It will be already 20 years ago. His name was Philip Hirschhorn. He was a friend from my parents' youth already, and he won the biggest violin competition that actually still is the major violin competition, the Queen Elizabeth competition in Brussels in the 60s. And he was just a magic figure, actually, sort of a mythical figure almost, but at the same time he was a close house friend. I considered him an uncle, and he would always stay with us when he would be teaching nearby. And so from a very young age, I would always play for him, and he was not the typical teacher that would tell you how to do things. He was not very pedagogical, but he would be an incredible example in how he played, and he would sometimes play on my teeny tiny violin and make it sound like his big violin to my ears.
Yeah.
And so that was incredibly influential, that you can hear what a sound can possibly be like, and so you start to aspire for more and more.
Was this in Amsterdam?
Close to Amsterdam. Close. I grew up near Utrecht, which is, well, I mean, in American standards, that's, I mean, 40 minutes away, so that's like nothing. But to us, it's a totally different region.
Yeah. Utrecht has a musical scene as well.
Yeah, very definitely.
Strong.
Yeah, definitely.
Early music, too.
Exactly. There's a very big early music festival there already for many, many years. Yeah.
So you were able to find other opportunities and a community of classical music orientation already there. So
definitely
wonderful environment.
Yeah,
as for a musician.
Yeah, sort of, because it's so natural. And so some people ask me, how is it to grow up in a musical family? I don't know any better. I find it sometimes much more interesting how people get to music when they don't grow up in a musical family, because then you need to really discover everything. For me, it was just so normal. It was not till I was about 19 and I had a boyfriend that was not from the music world that I discovered that there are people that have to do things in life that they don't really love or they're not really passionate about. For me, it was so normal that you combine your passion with your daily life and your work. And so I was, in that sense, let's call it spoiled, that I was able to make it my daily life.
Well, there are some things about being a professional musician that maybe aren't so fun.
Yeah, sure.
unless you really love competitions and auditioning.
Yeah, I mean, it is definitely a tough life. But once you get out there, since I've passed the whole competition age and been there, done that, and enjoyed it partly as well, because it's a growing experience. But now that I am really in the professional life, when I catch myself complaining, because there is a lot of pressure, you do have to get out there every time, and sort of because it's such a public life, you share your soul, so to say, on stage with 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 people in the hall. If you're not feeling great, you can be quite vulnerable, and the travel can be, heavy duty. I've had a couple of intense weeks also before this, but still, meanwhile, we're doing incredible music. So I do try to remember that, and not in the cliche way, but really in the way that it's all, even the traveling. I mean, who wouldn't dream of doing all of that?
Well, we're going to talk about your concerto in a little bit this hour. You're playing the concerto by Samuel Barber. The concert, again, is at 8 o'clock on Saturday in Miller Auditorium, and full details on tickets are at KalamazooSymphony.com. The rest of the program includes Grieg's Holberg Suite, very fun piece.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
filled with dance tunes.
Yeah.
And it concludes with one of the most marvelous showcases for the orchestra ever written, Béla Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra, with a guest conductor as well this week, meaning the director of the Bakersfield Symphony named Stylian Kirov. And the KSO musicians often get on their, very on their best game when a guest conductor appears. So it should be a very, very exciting program at 8 o'clock on Saturday. So Lisa, let us look to some of your recorded work. I'd like to hear something from a solo album you made, combining the works of Bach and Isai.
Mm-hmm.
One is a lot more famous than the other.
Right.
So I'd like to hear some of the Isai. Maybe you could just tell us a little about who Isai was.
Isai was actually the starter of what we would call now the modern violin school. He was this incredible virtuoso from the late 19th, early 20th century. And he really established the violin playing as we know it today, meaning, for example, if you speak about sound production and we're now so used to a very singing tone where vibrato is used very frequently. And Isai was the one that started that this continuous tone. But next to being an incredible player himself, at some point when he got a bit older, he started to compose more. He was also a great conductor. He was like a homo universalis. He could do everything. But his compositions are mainly geared towards the violin. And they are using the violin to all extents. Sort of, he uses every possible technique. And it's incredible lush music. And being written in the early 20th century, he does explore a little bit modernism, but barely, still very much from the Romantic tradition. And the piece I think you will play is our movements from the second sonata. And these there are six original sonatas, and they are inspired by Bach. And each sonata is written for a famous violinist of that time. And this specific sonata is written for Jacques Thibault, which was a great French violinist, Isai being Belgian himself. And in this particular sonata, he is very keen on using Bach examples. We're not listening to a movement where he's using that, but he's using the whole sonata is called Obsession, or in French, Obsession. And if we do it correctly, and the obsession here is with the Dies Irae theme. So you'll hear it in first in a very friendly way, and later slightly less friendly.
We heard two movements from the Sonata for Solo Violin, number three, I believe.
Number two.
Yep. By Jenny Zai.
Yep.
My guest, Lisa Ferstmann, was the soloist, and she will be soloist with the Kalamazoo Symphony on Saturday, beginning at 8 p.m., although I should make an announcement that for anyone who's curious about the music on the program and would like the conductor to talk them through it in a really relatable way, they can arrive at 7 p.m. for the prelude, which in this case will be conducted by the guest conductor, whose name is Stilian Kirov, who works with a couple of great American ensembles and is guest conducting on Saturday. So, Lisa, we were just about to take you to the United States in your life story.
Right.
You decided to go to school in the United States. What were some of the reasons for that decision?
Well, I hadn't heard about the Curtis Institute until I was about 18. And then there was this great Japanese, actually, violist Nabuko Imai, who used to go to Marlboro Music in the summer very often. And she had met many young students there that came from Curtis. And so she realized that that is a school where the really talented kids go. And so she pointed that out to me. And then I thought, okay, maybe I should try. And so I auditioned and I got in. And it was one of the best decisions I ever made, because indeed it is an extremely special school. It's very small. So they also tell you a lot of times once you've gotten in, that how special you are, because, you know, there were like whatever 700 applicants and they only chose the 37th for the first year. So it's they really pointed out, but you start feeling it as well, because it just creates a general level around you that's really very high. And so great teachers, but mainly also great students, and that's so stimulating. And for me, it was I think, yeah, the most important thing actually that I've made friends for life there, which you usually, of course, do in college. But here in particular, I made friends for life that are in such incredible walks of life in musical worlds, really high up there. And it's so great to keep meeting each other on the stage and really share that.
It would open possibilities.
Totally.
For many kinds of music making.
Exactly, yeah.
With your friends who go into different areas.
Yeah. And,
did you get to know any composers?
I did, actually. I'm not so much in touch with any of them, but I keep following what they do. I mean, they're compositional teachers also there that have been doing extremely well since then, like Jennifer Higdon, who's a big American composer now. And so it's great to see those names out there. Another composition student that's doing really well is now, I think, head of, not head of music, but it's very high up in the leader, I don't know what it's called, of Curtis, David Ludwig. And so it's great to see how everybody's thriving that went to that school.
The story of this school is such an interesting one. I think it was created by a benefactor.
Mm-hmm. Marie-Louise and Curtis Buck.
Was it all held in her residence or her mansion?
I think so. Yeah, it's an incredible, beautiful house on the corner of this is a beautiful square in Philadelphia, the Rittenhouse Square. And it's this gorgeous mansion. So you walk in there and your classes are in actual rooms, like proper rooms with fireplaces, right, and beautiful furniture and paintings and beautiful rugs. And every Wednesday we would have tea, and which would be served from samovars in the entrance room hallway. And it was all, you know, paneled ceilings and walls and wooden things and carpets, beautiful carpets, extremely atmospheric, and it definitely set a tone for the whole atmosphere around you.
Now, I believe that Samuel Barber, who composed the concerto you're playing, was in the same rooms,
absolutely,
learning to compose, yeah, as a young man.
I mean, that is incredible, no? That you get so close, actually, to that history. And it's such a recent history, of course, but did you actually know that just this morning, as I was sort of reading up on some details about the concerto, it stated that because there was he got this assignment to write this concerto by a particular violinist. And then once he was more or less finished, there was some debate about the last movement. And apparently there was like a type of playoff in one of the rooms, and they described the room, and they say the room where I have had most of my lessons, where they performed that last movement to show that it actually was possible to perform, because there was debate whether it was too hard or not. And this took place in that room, and I could imagine them standing there. Yeah, I've been in that room, and I've played there myself, so that's just an incredible feeling.
It must have been a little frustrating for Mr. Barber to have his brand new work questioned by the soloist.
Yeah, that's never nice. I mean, but that has happened over time quite a lot. I mean, famously, the Tchaikovsky violin concerto was completely debunked in a way by the
first soloist
saying it's too hard, it's unplayable. And also the Brahms concerto, people said it's a concerto against the violin. And, well, history over time has proven them wrong, obviously.
Yes.
And the same with the Barber concerto, thankfully.
He wrote just the one,
yeah,
sadly.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he has a wonderful cello concerto as well. So his lyricism for string players and a cello sonata, so that we at least hear, we know how he... how great he can write for the instrument, and he really does write incredibly well for the violin, and it's such a warm-hearted and sort of generous concerto, very lush. Or as I read somewhere, is there a sort of more immediate way to the heart with that beginning, for example, because the violin starts playing immediately, but there first there's like a rolling chord from the piano coming in, and then the sort of the whole orchestra joins and you join as well, and it's just, you know, it just opens up,
yes,
the arms in a way,
like
to the audience,
a heart swelling,
exactly, you know, exactly,
amazing,
yeah.
Amazing initial imprint,
yeah,
of a concerto, and that's why I say I wish he'd written at least
more.
Two more.
Yeah, I know. I know. Yeah.
But we do have this special work, and we will hear you playing it on Saturday at 8 p.m.
Yeah.
With a prelude at 7 p.m. Details online at KalamazooSymphony.com. Lisa Ferstmann, thank you so much for coming in to talk about this music.
Thank you.
And yourself as a performer. All the best on Saturday.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Let's listen to a performance of the Barber Concerto. We have James Ennis as soloist in this recording.